Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's Rural Health Clinics Technical Assistance National Teleconference, EHR Meaningful Use Proposed Rule. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Bill Finnerbrock. Please go ahead, sir.
Operator, and I'd like to welcome everybody to today's presentation on the Meaningful Use Proposed Standards for Rural Health Clinics and others to receive the EHR incentive payments. I am Bill Finnerbrock, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, and I'll be the moderator for today's call. We have two presenters with us today from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Jessica Kahn and Michelle Mills, who will go over the proposed standards for qualifying for the EHR incentive payments, timetables, and other relevant issues. Their presentation will last approximately 45 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. Just as a reminder, this call series is sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is presented in conjunction with the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. This is the Rural Health Clinic Technical Assistance Conference Call Series, and this is the 33rd call in that series, which began late 2004. As you know, there is no charge to participate in this series, and we encourage you to refer others who might benefit from this call to sign up and receive announcements regarding the call dates, topics, and presentations. If you want that information, you can go to the government website at www.ruralhealth.hrsa.gov/RHC. During the questions with our speakers, we will ask that you identify yourself by name and where you're calling from. And if you have questions or ideas for future topics you'd like to pass along, please send an email to info@narhc.org. All questions and answers we will try and get to. If there are questions for today that are not able to be answered in the time we have allotted and folks still want to submit a question, you can send it to that address. We will forward it on to the folks at CMS and try to get you an answer. Please follow along. Hopefully everyone has received the slides for today's call. And with that, I'd like to turn over control to Jessica and Michelle. It's all yours. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting us. I'm Jessica Kahn. I'm a technical director for HIT here at CMS in the Medicaid area. And today, Michelle and I'll let her introduce herself in a moment. Michelle and I are going to talk to you about the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking for HITECH, which is the act within the recovery bill that was signed almost a year ago in 2009. So this is the part that focuses on health information technology. And within that, there were some provisions specifically for EHR incentive programs for Medicaid and Medicare. And we're going to talk to you today about the Medicaid provisions because we think those are the ones that are most applicable for the rural health centers. So again, just a little overview of HITECH, though I think probably most of you are familiar with this as it is, so we're not going to go too much into it or we'll be preaching to the choir. But the overview of HITECH, the purpose of this is to improve outcomes and reduce costs and simplify care, facilitate access, and all of the things that we believe that health information technology can do for healthcare services. So that's the long-term goals. The short-term goal of this program are to actually make incentive payments. This is part of the stimulus bill. And the thought is by encouraging broad EHR adoption through these incentives, we'll get to our longer-term goals that I described a moment ago. So for Medicaid, there's some particularities for our program, which we're going to get into. But then at the federal level, we have an additional role which has to do with policy development and enforcement and regulation writing. And that's the process that we're in right now. And so our hope is by offering you this presentation today and answering what questions we can, that can help you in making some informed comments, because we do really want to hear from the rural health center's perspective what you feel about this EHR incentive program, how achievable is it, and where you might have some areas of concern or suggestions. So we also have to think about what's the strategic vision for Medicaid, how this fits in with other quality programs we have, other health information technology programs we have, and even those within other HHS and other federal agencies. We work very closely with HRSA and have obviously a lot of federally qualified health centers and rural health centers are Medicaid providers. And so at the local level, these are invisible silos, we hope. So we're looking at our vision and how it comports with our federal partners. And then defining things that have to do with operations and making sure we're leveraging the resources that are available to us and to states. And we're going to talk a little bit about where this has particular interest for rural health centers, whereas the rest of our presentation is fairly general and is true across all populations, and we'll explain to you where there are differences. So the caveat, of course, is that this is proposed policy. We put out a notice of proposed rulemaking on January 13th. The comment period will close on March 15th, on the Ides of March. And so it's all subject to change in the final rule, and all comments should be made through regulations.gov. And any questions or comments that you have with us today, that we really appreciate them and we find them very useful, we want to make sure that you would also submit them through regulations.gov so they can be officially noted. Okay, so what's not in our proposed rule? This is not the rule that talks about the requirements for certification of electronic health record or the standards for an electronic health record or the process by which electronic health records will become certified and by whom. Those are all addressed in rulemaking from the Office of the National Coordinator for HIT. They have a notice of proposed rulemaking that was just issued on Tuesday, and they also have an interim final rule that was issued the same time as ours in January that covered these two topics. There's no information in our rule about applying for HIT or E grants or cooperative agreements. Again, those were allocated funds through the Office of the National Coordinator, and you can go to their website at healthit.gov for information about funding opportunities that have been awarded or might be coming in the future. And our reg does not talk about any changes to HIPAA that were also enacted as part of the high-tech legislation. So now I'm going to turn it over to Michelle, who's going to go over the eligibility questions for who can participate and receive an incentive.
Hi, everyone. My name is Michelle Mills. I'm a health policy analyst here at the Centers for Medicaid and State Operations. I'm going to cover eligibility and payment policies first. And between Jessica and I, we might discuss terms and concepts that sound confusing at first, but our goal is to tie them together at the end of the presentation. So you should make sure you're taking down any questions and notes as we go through the presentation so that if we don't get your questions answered throughout the presentation, you can ask them at the end. I'm going to stay out of the weeds for our justifications as much as possible today, and those interested, if you haven't already, should read the preamble. That's really the best way to get informed on our thinking for the proposed policies we're going to talk about. Again, as Jessica just said, please submit your questions formally through regulations.gov. We want to make sure that our final rule is the best product possible. And again, this is just proposed thinking now, and we're out talking to folks like you about this so that you can understand what our proposed thinking is and then make informed comments by March 15th. So with that, I'm going to start on slide 5, which talks about providers that are eligible for the Medicaid incentives. So when we talk about eligible providers in Medicaid, there are two groups, the eligible professionals, or EPs as we call them, and eligible hospitals. There are five different practitioner types that we think of when we say EPs, and those are the physicians, nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, dentists, and then physician's assistants are only eligible for this program when practicing at a federally qualified health center or a rural health clinic that is so led by a physician's assistant. So we want to make sure that we're clear on that last one. And then hospitals are eligible for this program insofar as they are acute care hospitals or children's hospitals. So those are all of those are eligible providers in Medicaid. So moving to slide 6, eligible hospitals. When we say an eligible hospital, what do we mean? Well, a hospital will have a CMS certification number. So we've proposed that one CMS certification number equals one hospital for purposes of participating in this program. Early on, we had a question from the community asking if they had a separate tax ID number from the hospital, does that make them eligible to participate in this program for purposes of an incentive? And the answer to that would be no. You need to have one CMS certification number for purposes of participating in this program. So the statute identified that acute care hospitals and children's hospitals would be eligible for incentives but didn't define either of those facilities. So in the NPRM, we proposed that an acute care hospital would be a facility where the average length of stay was 25 days or fewer, and the CCN fell within the range specified there on the slide. This includes the 11 cancer hospitals nationally. Children's hospitals we proposed would be the 78 children's hospitals nationally where the CCN fell within the range specified there on the slide. And it's notable that this does not include the pediatric wings of larger hospitals. Moving to slide 7, patient volume is probably the largest indicator of eligibility for this program. And Medicaid EPs can be eligible by one of two ways. The first is in the middle column here, and that's not being hospital-based, and then the EPs can meet these patient volume requirements shown in the middle part of the slide. Or EPs can practice predominantly in an FQHC or RHC and serve needy individuals. So, for example, if I'm a nurse practitioner, I can participate in this program when I have 30% of my patient volume derived from the Medicaid population, or I can practice predominantly in an FQHC or an RHC and have 30% of my patient volume derived from needy individuals. And I'm going to describe on the next slide here in just a minute what I mean by practices predominantly and needy individuals. Additionally, acute care hospitals have to have 10% patient volume to be eligible to participate, and children's hospitals do not have any patient volume requirements. So moving to slide 8, the statute doesn't define practices predominantly, and we propose that an EP does so when the clinical location for more than 50% of their patient encounters over a six-month period occurs at an FQHC or an RHC. Furthermore, needy individuals is specified in the statute, but we wanted to highlight it here, and it includes the groups that are listed here on the slide, which are Medicaid and CHIP enrollees, patients furnished uncompensated care by the provider, or furnished free or sliding scale services. Moving to slide 9, the statute does exclude most hospital-based eligible professionals, and the statute defines the term hospital-based eligible professional to mean a professional who furnishes substantially all of the individual's professional services in a hospital setting, whether inpatient or outpatient, and through the use of the facilities and equipment of the hospital, including qualified EHRs. The determination of whether an eligible professional is hospital-based shall be made on the basis of the site of service and without regard to any employment or billing arrangement between the EP and any other provider. I'm sure a lot of folks on the call are very familiar with this and have read the statute carefully. The important terms here to clarify in the NPRM included substantially all, hospital setting, and site of service. So moving to slide 10, the way we proposed to resolve some of those terms from the statute in the NPRM included the following. Site of service would be resolved by using the place of service codes on the CMS 1500 claims form. Substantially all would be met when more than 90% of the threshold of services delivered in a hospital setting. The hospital setting would be any combination of services in an inpatient or outpatient setting, including the ER. States, from the Medicaid perspective, states would include their methodology in their state Medicaid HIT plan, and I'll cover in the second part of my discussion today what a state Medicaid HIT plan is. So moving to slide 11, EPs at rural health clinics. We know we have a lot of providers on the phone today from rural health clinics. And now that we've covered all the ways that a provider can participate, we wanted to make sure we drilled down and were specific about how practitioners at rural health clinics can participate in this program. So for any of the EPs that we talked about on slide 5, so doctors, nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, dentists, or PAs insofar as they practice predominantly in the RHC that is so led by a PA, they can participate in the program by the two ways we talked about on slide 7. By meeting the patient volume requirements, for example, having 30% of their practice derived from Medicaid and not being hospital-based, or they can also participate by practicing predominantly in an RHC, like we talked about on slide 8. Again, this is just talking about with respect to providers at RHCs. Like all other providers, professionals in RHCs must meet all of the other program requirements. For example, they can't be sanctioned and they must be licensed appropriately. So moving to slide 12, now we're going to cover payments. We're going to stay at the 30,000-foot level because we could spend hours talking about the payment requirements. However, in the NPRM, we cover a number of areas, such as registration requirements, hospital payments, the derivation of the incentive payments for EPs, and we have begun rolling out the requirements to the states with how they will register and enroll providers in the program. So moving to slide 13, just briefly to cover some issues with payments with regards to timing. We have made efforts to align the program with the Medicaid program with Medicare. Medicare has a statutory implementation date of 2011. Medicaid did not have a statutory implementation date. You'll see many places in the notice of proposed rulemaking where we did make program alignment policy suggestions. Another place where we did this was we proposed that EPs would be paid on the calendar year and hospitals would be paid on the federal fiscal year. We thought this made sense for providers wishing to possibly change between the programs. It made sense for us and states in terms of explaining the program. Additionally, we proposed that for states who are ready to make early payments for adopt, implement, and upgrade, this is not for meaningful use, they would be able to make payments earlier than 2011 if they have certain safeguards in place. So that is one place where we did deviate from Medicare. So Jess is going to talk a little bit more about adopt, implement, and upgrade and meaningful use.
Okay, so now you know who's eligible for an incentive and who's not, to some extent, and you know that they need to use a certified EHR, and I hope that everyone is clear that the process by which EHR is certified is under ONC's rulemaking. But then you actually have to do one of two things in order to receive the incentive payment with that EHR. For Medicaid, and this is only for Medicaid, the bar for the professional or the hospital's first year of participating in the program is not meaningful use. The bar that has to be met in order to receive a payment, if you've met all these other eligibility criteria, is adopt, implement, or upgrade. And that's from the statute, but in our proposed rule, we define those things. So I'm going to go through them and explain them and what they mean, and then I'll talk you through from there to how you get to meaningful use. So adopt, implement, and upgrade. So for adopting, and I'm on slide 14, well, now I'm moving, I guess, to slide 15. All right, but I'll go back to slide 14 in a moment. So for adopting, we're talking about activities that demonstrate that the provider has acquired or installed an electronic health record. So this is not, as we like to joke here, surfing the net to see what's there, walking around the exhibition hall at HIMSS last week, or wandering through Best Buy. This is actually making concrete and demonstrable actions towards the acquisition and installation of certified electronic health record technology. Or implementation. Implementation could mean you already have it, but you haven't taken it out of the box. And so now you need to train your staff on it. You need to do the data entry for all the patient demographics. You need to write data use agreements or business partner agreements for your HIPAA trading partners with the personal health information. You need to actually start to use it and optimize what you have already adopted. Or the third part of adopt and implement and upgrade is the upgrading piece. And this is really, in my mind, the slam dunk for everyone in Medicaid in the early part right now because, say, 2011, 2012. Because right now, let's be clear, there are no certified electronic health records for meaningful use on the market. None. Because the proposed rule for the Office of the National Coordinator has not been made final. They are going through comments and then they will finalize the rule around the same time as ours in late spring. And the process by which they're going to certify EHRs was just released in an NPRM and is likewise not finalized. So while there might be certified EHRs out there through another process, those that are certified for meaningful use, which is the kicker for this program, do not yet exist. So everyone who is already using something, they've already adopted, and they've already implemented, must upgrade to this new certified EHR in order to be able to get the EHR incentive program. So all the EHRs on the market who want to play in this space are going to have to obtain certification. So upgrading to what I have on the slide is version 2.0, but you know, it could be 10.0. It doesn't matter what they call it. But just by upgrading from what you have to the EHR certified version for meaningful use, you will have met the adopt, implement, and upgrade bar. And assuming you've met all these other eligibility criteria, there's your check. I think that's really important for people to understand because for Medicare, they have to meet meaningful use right out of the gate. So now let's talk about meaningful use. Meaningful use is not just having the electronic health record and just entering the patient demographic data or just doing the staff training, but you're really still focusing on what's going on inside your provider's office. You kind of pick and choose which functions you want to use, and it's not really going to get you, at the end of the day, to improve quality of care. And the analogy we like to use, and forgive me if you've heard me say this before, is the cell phone. So everyone has a cell phone, and they use it to make calls. Maybe occasionally you might text, though hopefully not while you're driving. But that's all you really do with it. That's the cell phone. That would be my grandmother, by the way. So that's what it is, and she likes the big buttons. Then there's the people who have the smartphone, right? So you know who you are. So the smartphone has GPS on it. It can capture your email. It has all kinds of apps that do amazing things. You can play lightsaber. You can play games on it. It connects to the internet. It transforms your life. It helps you remember things. It connects you when you're outside of your home or your office. It's enabling you to do things in your life that you wouldn't otherwise do if you were just using the cell phone like my grandmother does to answer the phone and occasionally text. I mean, nowadays they can even take video. It's amazing. So this is talking about the difference between just having something and having something that you meaningfully use that is truly changing your life. So how do you get from adopt, implement, and upgrade of a certified EHR to meaningful use of an EHR? Well, Congress had at least three ideas about this that they put into the statute. So regardless of comments, these three elements are going to be there in the final rule. And on slide 16, I say what those are. The first is e-prescribing. And e-prescribing, by the way, is not just the ability to send a prescription electronically from the provider's office to the pharmacy. E-prescribing can also involve matching what's being prescribed to a formulary, making a suggestion to the provider if there is a generic alternative, alerting the provider if there are allergies or dose-to-dose interactions that are potential or contraindications that are there based upon what's known about that patient's medication history. So EHR has a real potential, and there's already an evidence base to show an improvement in healthcare quality outcomes, reducing the risk of adverse events and improving costs or reducing costs. The second is the electronic exchange of health information. This is not about digitizing health records so that you can make more space in your office, no more filing cabinets. This is about being able to take the health information and move it with the patient everywhere that they go so that when they go to the hospital in the ER, their data is there, and they don't have to remember what the medication is, whether it's a blue pill, a yellow pill, what dose it was. It's all right there in the hand of the practitioner in the ER. Or if they go and they're referred someplace to another provider for specialty care, that new provider can see what their lab results were. So the data is moving in and out of the different provider settings, and that's critical to get to where we want to go for our healthcare, for health reform and for our healthcare setting. And the third is clinical quality measures. So this is, again, tying the use of the EHR to the actual clinical quality data so that it can drive provider behavior change. And so it's written in the statute that the provider would submit the clinical quality measures in a form and manner approved by the secretary, and we've proposed that for Medicare they would go to CMS, and for Medicaid they would be submitted to the state. So now moving to slide 17, I'm going to talk about those clinical quality measures very quickly. For an eligible professional, we propose that there are three core measures that all EPs would have to report on. But I want to point out here that if your patient population is not in the denominator of these, then they don't apply to you. So they are tobacco screening, blood pressure management, and medication management to the elderly. So if you're a pediatrician who's working at a rural health center, you are not going to be obliged to report clinical quality measures on medication management in the elderly because that's not in the denominator. You do not serve those patients. So what you would do, though, and what all EPs we propose would have to do, is in addition to those core measures that apply, you would select from a set of specialty measures. So if you're a pulmonologist or a pediatrician or a primary care provider or a cardiologist, there's all of those in the proposed rule, and you would pick from those. And our goal is, and it says this in the preamble, to narrow those lists down to a smaller set of core measures, I'm sorry, of specialty measures for each of those. So that's why we're soliciting comments on those that are there. Hospitals, we propose, must report on all of the clinical quality measures for whom that apply to the patients, regardless of payer, during the reporting period. However, the list, as you can see, is fairly, shall we say, over 21-centric. So we propose an alternative list for Medicaid, which includes some newborn measures and pediatric measures because, as you remember, children's hospitals are specifically included in our Medicaid program. I should also say we propose in the rule that states may receive the clinical quality measures starting in 2012, but in 2011, if they so choose, they can accept a provider's attestation on this data. Okay, so for hospitals, on slide 18, you'll see that they may receive an incentive from some of them, from both Medicare and Medicaid. So in subsection D, acute care hospitals might actually receive a payment for both. And hospitals that meet the Medicaid meaningful use requirements, the Medicare meaningful use requirements might be deemed as having met them for Medicaid so that they don't have to jump through the hoop twice for the same thing. And the reason that that's important and what I'm talking about on this slide when I talk about an expanded definition of meaningful use is we did propose that states have the ability to propose to CMS, subject to our approval, tweaking of the meaningful use definition for their specific state needs. So this is not expanding the functionality of an EHR beyond the EHR certification criteria because that would render moot the whole idea of having an ONC, Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval, on each EHR. The idea is that they all need to be able to do the same thing. That's the whole idea behind having this national certification. But perhaps you would want to do something specific in your state where you would point to a particular health information exchange, or you would point to a particular immunization registry, or you would focus on producing lists of diseases for particular conditions that you feel like or you're prioritizing for the population in your state. So a state might request to CMS that they would want to tailor the meaningful use definition. I should also say at this point that this is a 10-year program. They might not all want to do that in 2011. They might feel like the stage one definition of meaningful use that we've proposed is only 2 inches off the ceiling as it is, this floor definition for Medicare and Medicaid. So there's not really wiggle room for there. But once they have more in place and they've got more established, maybe 3 or 4 years from now, then they might come back to us and say, okay, we want to add some particularities to the meaningful use definition, whichever it is that's defined at that point, probably stage two at that point. The other thing I want to talk about is that I'm not sure if you are all as familiar with CHIPRA, but it was enacted around the same time as HITECH in 2009. It's the Children's Health Bill, and one of the things that it asks of CMS is that we develop, along with a lot of external stakeholder input, some pediatric core measures, and those have to do not necessarily with just measuring pediatric care in a provider setting, but also on a population level, and to think broadly about that. So in December of 2009, we published in the Federal Register a core set of 25 initial measures. At the same time, we were developing the meaningful use definition, so we thought it behooves us if the same pediatric providers are going to be reporting clinical quality measures under CHIPRA and under HITECH, where we could find an overlap between those two, we would try to. Well, not all measures are ready for electronic extraction. They haven't been defined, or perhaps they haven't been endorsed by the National Quality Foundation, or they're not things that would normally ever even be captured in an electronic health record or a paper health record for that measure. So what we came up with are four that are listed on slide 19. I'll just preempt the question because we received it before. Why specifically these four? And the reason isn't because we thought, you know, the BMI measure was the best thing since sliced bread. It was because, like I said, we had to pick from a list of pediatric measures, and I think most people would agree it's not a really long list right now, that are endorsed national consensus measures that have been what we say retooled for electronic extraction from electronic health records. So they are mapped in such a way that we can extract them from EHRs, apples to apples to apples, regardless of EHR, in a standardized fashion using a standardized vocabulary. So it's not a very long list, and so this is what we came up with and proposed for both that stage one definition meaningful use and the initial core set for CHIPRA, and we hope to evolve that as we move along and continue that alignment where appropriate. So the reason we think we have so much runway ahead of us is because this is a 10-year program. We go through 2021. Medicare only goes through 2016. The latest that a Medicaid provider can initiate the program is 2016. And like I said, they can initiate the program under that adopt, implement, and upgrade bar at any time, but then in their second and all their subsequent years in the program, they must meet meaningful use, and they must meet the definition of meaningful use that's in place at that time. So right now we've proposed a stage one, but our goal is by 2015, both Medicare and Medicaid, that everybody would be at stage three. And stage three, as we described in the preamble, is a much stronger focus on outcomes as opposed to data collection. So now Michelle's going to get back to tell you a little bit more about what are the conditions for the state and the funding that CMS makes available for them to enable this program.
Okay, and for this part, I just want to say, hopefully your eyes don't glaze over. We wouldn't talk to you about this part if we didn't think it was important. We really want providers to have a global understanding of how this program works and what the states are going to be responsible for doing to get you your money, because we think it will help with, first of all, you making informed comments on the notice of proposed rulemaking, but also the states are required to get stakeholder input for some of their requirements. So we think you having a global understanding of the whole program will really help with the stakeholder input process as well. So with that, on slide 21, I'm going to talk about conditions for state participation. First, the way we like to talk about this is the states get two buckets of money if they decide to participate in this program. The first is a 90% federal match for administration of the EHR incentive program. And then the second bucket is 100% federal match as reimbursement for payments to providers for the incentives. In other words, the feds are going to reimburse the state for the money that the provider gets for the actual incentive. And then we're going to give a 90% federal match for the states administering the entire program. To ensure this money is to ensure proper and efficient use of high-tech dollars. CMS will use the what we call the Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS, Expenditure and Approval System, that we currently have in place for our systems or sort of IT programs. So when you see Advanced Planning Document, or APD, it might look familiar to some folks because we currently use this process in other places in our Medicaid program. For high-tech states, so states that do decide to participate in this program, because, again, it is voluntary, states will request money for reasonable administrative expenses at a 90% match for planning activities for this program. The vehicle for that will be the planning APD, or what we're calling here the PAPD, and then states will create a state Medicaid HIT plan or a state Medicaid health IT plan. I told you earlier I'd explain that, and I'm still going to get to that. So states will draft this state Medicaid health IT plan as a deliverable of their PAPD. We currently have 35 PAPDs approved, and four are pending here at CMS right now. So most states are getting those in. States are going to draft that state Medicaid HIT plan as a deliverable of their planning APD, and they must consider certain principles that we've laid out for them. When states are ready to implement their state Medicaid HIT plan, they will request funding through an implementation APD or an IAPD. The IAPD will outline states' implementation activities for the incentive program and request funding at the 90% federal match for reasonable administrative expenses for implementation activities. The federal financial participation or the money that we give states cannot flow without approval of these documents by CMS. So just to recap, states must do some planning to get ready for all of this, and we're very generous, so we're going to pay 90% of the planning costs. But we want to know all of the particulars of what they plan to do, so we've outlined what they have to do to request that planning money in a PAPD. The deliverable of the PAPD is the state Medicaid HIT plan, and we can't have the states out in the wilderness just planning in perpetuity, so with no results. So we said they have to get a state Medicaid HIT plan back to us, so that's the deliverable. The next step is the state has to have this detailed state Medicaid HIT plan, and there's a lot of requirements associated with that. When they've determined how much it's going to cost to implement this program, say it's $100 million, they have to request that money from us through an IAPD, so that's the implementation APD, and we have to know why they're requesting $100 million. So we'll review the IAPD and the state Medicaid HIT plan to make sure they're going to be able to meet all the requirements in the program to successfully implement the incentives. We'll release the 90% federal match for the $100 million if we agree that that's what they need to meet the program requirements. And then as the incentives come up, then we'll release the 100% cost as well. So that's going to be the actual money that the state will pay to the providers. So moving to slide 22, we talked here about the 90% match and versus the 10% money that the state has to put forward themselves. So we just talked about the two buckets of money, one of which being the 90% bucket for administering the program. But in order to get that money, states must do three things. The first is administer the incentives. That includes tracking meaningful use by eligible professionals and eligible hospitals. The second is to conduct oversight, including routine tracking of attestations and reporting mechanisms. The third is pursue initiatives to encourage the adoption of certified EHR technology for the promotion of healthcare quality and the exchange of healthcare information. So the first two seem relatively straightforward, but the third one is straight out of statute. It's one of those things that Congress came up with us to implement here. So we've thought long and hard about what that means and how we can provide some flexible but transparent guidance for states. So we have publicly put forward some information for states about exactly what those things mean. And we are working with states so that they can get that into their planning documents. On slide 23, we're going to talk about state Medicaid HIT plans. The state Medicaid HIT plan must include three key elements. The first is, what is the current landscape in the state, or the as-is world, as we call it? Next is, what is the state's HIT vision for the next 5 years? We also call this the 2B world. We expect the state to use benchmarks along the way. The last element is, how will the state implement and oversee a successful EHR program? So once the state establishes their baseline assessment, they can plan the steps necessary to transition towards achieving some of the objectives in HITECH, such as improving both quality and healthcare outcomes, which will get them to their 2B world. In considering the third element of the state Medicaid HIT plan, the state must include detailed information about the verifiable data sources that they will use to determine provider eligibility, and this is important for providers. They will look at everything from patient volume to whether the EPs are hospital-based to whether providers are sanctioned. We would further expect a detailed plan in the state Medicaid HIT plan for calculating and dispersing payments, coordinating with stakeholders, contracting with health plans, privacy and security, curtailing fraud and abuse, et cetera. CMS views the state Medicaid HIT plan as a linchpin to the state's success with this program. Moving to slide 24, we talk about financial oversight and program integrity, which is definitely becoming more of an important issue at CMS. Over the last several years, it's become more and more of an important issue, and most recently we're going through some organizational changes here at CMS that has put that definitely in the limelight, so you'll expect to see that as a very important issue here. With all of this money we're giving states, there's some great responsibility, and we at CMS and the states will be continuing to develop audit strategies for how we will make sure that the funds are expended properly within the new and existing rules. The HITECH statute requires that there be no duplication of payment between Medicare and Medicaid, And in our regulations, we also said that there would be no duplication of payment between states as well. So we accomplished this in one setting by proposing that there would be a national level repository or a single front door for providers to register and pick either Medicare or Medicaid. And then if you pick Medicaid, you would pick one state. And we believe that this will eliminate any duplicative payments between the programs or between states. See here. Additionally, CMS is moving forward with how we're going to implement that national level repository and integrate those systems with state systems. Moving to slide 25, we talk about the differences between Medicare and Medicaid here, and this slide is really for your reference, but it shows some notable policy differences between the two programs. We just wanted to highlight a couple. The eligible professionals are paid different amounts. You get more in Medicaid. The program lasts longer in Medicaid through 2021, and there are no federally mandated payment adjustments or penalties, some people call them, in Medicaid program for people who are not meaningful users. Moving to slide 26, what's next? As we've talked about a couple times here, we're nearing the end of our public comment period. The last day you can submit comments for the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking is March 15th. We really hope that you will submit comments if you have them. It will make the final rule a better product. We have many states and territories, like I said earlier, with approved PAPDs, and then they are now working on their state Medicaid HIT plans, and we're very excited to be providing them technical assistance and working on that process with them. We expect to issue new guidance soon on the implementation APDs, and we're continuing to work with our federal partners at a number of agencies, both inside and outside of HHS. So this does, of course, include our partners at the Office of the National Coordinator, but also our partners at HRSA and ARC and many other agencies. That includes the FCC. That might be of importance to folks in the rural areas. They're coordinating some broadband grants. And we, on slide 27, we just, again, direct folks where they can make comments for this Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. So with that, I think we finished up just under 45 minutes.
Thank you, both Jessica and Michelle. It was very helpful. Operator, what I'd like to do is open it up for questions. If you could give folks the instructions for how to ask a question.
Certainly, ladies and gentlemen, the question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using your speakerphone, please release your mute function to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Also, a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open to ask your question. We ask that you please state your name and your location before posing your question. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question.
Thanks. And while we're waiting for the questions to line up, just you mentioned that I believe 35 states had already obtained approval for their plan and 4 were pending. Is that list available so folks can know that their states are prepared to offer the incentive payments for the adoption, implementation, and upgrading of their EHR?
Sure. Actually, CMS issues a press release every time we approve a planning, advanced planning document. So if you go to the CMS website and you click on Newsroom, you can see the press releases. Sometimes we've done them in bulk. For example, last week we issued one that announced the approval of 13 states altogether. But you can certainly go back and see historically which are the 35 states. We hope to have the other 4 out by the middle of next week. And then the other states that don't have one approved, we're working with them to help them get on board and provide technical assistance. But the states and the dollar amounts are all listed in the press releases.
Okay. Operator, do we have any questions?
We do. And your first question will come from caller. Please state your name and your location.
Hi, my name is Ron Gleason, and I'm calling from Great Falls, Montana. At the beginning of the program, there was an assumption made that the important program for rural health clinics was the Medicaid side of this. In Montana, we are a very large number of small farming communities with very high Medicare populations and very low Medicaid populations. So the Medicare program side is what's important to us, not the Medicaid side. Secondly, we in Montana operate almost exclusively in these rural communities with provider-based rural health clinics. And it's my understanding that the Medicare program will not reimburse provider-based rural health clinics that operate as a Department of a Critical Access Hospital. So the vast majority of Montanans that live in rural areas will not be covered by electronic health records because there is no money to do it. And I'm just kind of curious how that will be addressed.
That's a great question. And Jessica and I work for the Medicaid Center here at CMS, and we were invited to come and talk about the Medicaid portion of the NPRM. But if the folks working on this call were interested in arranging for another call with the Medicare folks or another call where we talk, we've done this before, where we talk about globally the high-tech issues, I'm sure we could arrange that as well. However, with respect to your question about the hospital-based requirements, I think there have been a number of stories reported about how the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking requirements will impact provider-based clinics negatively. And there is a legislative fix that has been proposed in the jobs bill. And I don't think that I'm saying anything wrong here by talking about that because it's public information right now. It of course, hasn't been signed or passed completely yet. So we'll wait and see what happens with that. At CMS, we are eager to see there be a fix that would correct where we see our hands being tied right now by the statutory language.
Majority of these facilities are critical access hospital-based, and the only logical solution is to just have them as another department of the hospital and pay them just like the rest of the critical access hospital. The only logical solution.
Well, we hope that folks who have solutions as they see them would propose them through the comment period. We put forward a number of solutions in the NPRM as we saw them, and then we asked for comments in that section. So,
and Ron, if when you're making your comments you want to speak specifically to any data that you have in Montana, that would be very helpful.
Ron, can I just add to that that as they've alluded to, several of these issues that you've raised are a reflection of the way the statute was written. These were not proposals or recommendations that necessarily came from the association or the REC community. We were asked to respond to different proposals that were presented to us. We did raise the Medicare issue that for many RHCs, the Medicare population is the more significant population than Medicaid, but the decision was made in the political environment to restrict it to the special RHC to the Medicaid portion. If you want to send me an email, I'd be happy to talk to you more because being from Montana, as you know, your senator is a key participant in these discussions, and I'd be happy to try and get you in touch with his staff so you can articulate your concerns to them directly. But as was also mentioned, there is legislation that is pending for inclusion in the jobs bill that would address the provider base issue on the Medicare side in the same way that it has relief is available for rural health clinics on the Medicaid side.
If I could just clarify, both Medicare and Medicaid are impacted in the same way right now, which is that provider-based clinics are excluded.
Rural health.
Yeah. And so the jobs bill, the language would propose a fix for both. And so for folks who are interested in, again, reviewing what we've written in the NPRM, it starts on page 1904, and we do clarify exactly what is in statute and where we had discretion. And we put out a couple of proposals and then asked for comments. And so we'd love to have your comments, and that would be great.
Next question, operator.
And that question will come from caller. Please state your name and location.
Hi, my name is Heather Paulson, and I'm in a provider-based rural health clinic attached to a critical access hospital on the north coast of California in Fort Bragg, California. And I just, my question has kind of already been asked by Ron in Montana. We also have the largest proportion of our patients being Medicare patients, and we are also attached to a critical access hospital, and we're a multi-specialty clinic. We have about 15 providers who provide services here to the coast. Without an electronic medical record, we are unable to connect to our hospital in a meaningful way, and I just think it's critical that the provider-based clinics be included as well. It makes no sense to me that it wouldn't be covered under any branch of the incentive funding.
Thanks, Heather. Next question?
Next question comes from?
Go ahead, caller.
This is Tom, and I'm calling from Poplar Bluff, Missouri. I have a question on the patient volumes. The minimum Medicaid patient volume, is that based on patient visits or discrete patients? The other question is, on the predominantly needy individuals, would that include dual eligibles, like Medicare and Medicaid, patients who have both?
Sure, those are great questions. The way we've proposed the language, let me take those questions separately, I guess. The way we've proposed the language right now in the NPRM, I would actually refer you to the proposed regulations, which is where we state that the encounter would be covered by Medicaid.
That's an encounter is the unit of analysis.
The visit is the unit rather than the total number of patients.
Okay.
The denominator is total number of visits or encounters, and then the numerator is what proportion of those are Medicaid. However, we do suggest and solicit comments that there are other ways to define this, such as provider panel or proportion of cost and so forth. So we do solicit comments on other means to define patient volume.
And then what about the dual eligibles?
Oh, right. And so the dual eligibles would be, again, this is since the patient encounter would need to be covered by Medicaid. And so
for needy individuals.
Oh. So you're asking if they were dual Medicare, Medicaid?
Yes. If an individual is a dual Medicare, Medicaid, would they qualify as a Medicaid patient for either the Medicaid 30% threshold or the needy threshold, since they are at least partially being covered by Medicaid?
Yes.
So they would be countable as a Medicaid patient if they're a dual eligible?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Next question, operator.
And that'll come from?
Go ahead, caller.
This is John Hansen from Washington State. Some statutory language makes a distinction between hospitals and critical access hospitals. When you refer to acute care hospitals, does that include CAHs?
CAHs are not included in acute care hospitals. On the slide you have in front of you, there's a list of CCNs that are included, and CAHs have CCNs that are not included in that range.
Okay. I have a second question. That is,
and that is our proposed thinking right now. So if you have comments about why or critical access hospitals should be included, you should review why we propose acute care hospitals to be defined the way they are and submit comments on that.
Okay, we'll do that. You also mentioned that RHCs can be eligible for PAs if they are PA-led. Does that mean PA-owned or in charge or what?
We're silent on that. That's statutory language that just says PA-led. And if you have comments or questions or suggestions about that, you should include that formally through eggs.gov.
We expect that that term will be clarified in the final rule, which is why we think it's important to comment on that.
Yeah, okay. John, I think that's what I was going to say is that that's one of the areas where it is noticeably silent, and I do think that it's important for folks to comment. The association will be commenting on that as to what we believe constitutes or should be defined as a PA-led clinic.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next caller.
And that'll come from?
Pete McGee, Lake Village, Arkansas. I have two questions, Bill. One, we implemented our EHR in 2004. And, of course, we've done several upgrades, but, I mean, how will this affect the incentive payments? Will we still be eligible for those?
That's a great question, and you would be a prime candidate for the upgrade part of the adopt, implement, and upgrade. So if you have an EHR, whatever version it is now, whichever brand, whether it was self-developed, open source, or something that you bought or developed off the shelf, and you have to get it certified for meaningful use. And so what the Office of the National Coordinator has proposed is a process by which that will happen, and EHRs are basically, for those that already exist, they would do an analysis between what the capacity of that EHR currently is and the proposed definition of meaningful use, and then the EHR would have to meet that gap, fill that gap in order to get certified. So if you were to, if your EHR were to do so and get certified and you upgraded and to that new certified version, then you would have met the adopt, implement, and upgrade bar for your first participation year, and you'd be all set and on your way to meaningful use.
Okay, my second question is the maximum incentive under Medicaid is $63,750.
Right.
That is per provider. Is that correct?
Per eligible professional. Hospitals have a different incentive methodology.
Okay, and that's over a five-year period, is it?
It's over a six-year period. You have first year, as we proposed, you have your first year where you adopt, implement, and upgrade, and then five following years of meaningful use.
And the adopt, implement, and upgrade, the first year is the biggest chunk. It's 21 and change, 21,000 and change, and then the subsequent years it's a lesser amount. Medicare as well, the way they proposed to allocate their incentive payment, the payments are larger in the earlier years.
The Medicaid side, however, talks about allowable costs.
Yes.
In the case of a clinic that is upgrading, how will the allowable cost be calculated? In other words, the maximum, it's 85% of 24,000. Will they have to show receipts or costs that equate to 24,000 in order to get that the full value? Or is it going to be assumed that in the course of upgrading their existing system, they had cost at that level?
We expect that states will make calculations for providers to comply with the net average allowable cost and the average allowable cost requirements. And we also expect states, as we've laid out in our proposed regulations, to have audit requirements in place. And so beyond that, each state will have different requirements probably for what they will request of providers for how they comply with these requirements.
So providers might be advised to either keep receipts or keep documentation of cost for training of staff if you're upgrading your system, the actual cost of the upgrade, anything of that nature, in the event that as part of this you are required to provide documentation?
I think that's safe. I mean, you're going to be at some point attesting to meeting certain requirements, and I'm sure there will be some, you know, lengthy statement about upon penalty of tar and feathering, the state will come out and, you know, audit you at some point, or you're potentially, you know, attesting to meeting these things and knowing that the state could audit you. And I would assume, I mean, just like when we file our taxes, that those are potential methods that the state may employ.
So if I were the director of a rural health clinic that was making a certified EHR available to the professionals who work at that clinic, then I would think about being able to safeguard that information on behalf of the eligible professionals, because, again, they're qualifying receiving these payments themselves. The clinic is not. But if the clinic has furnished them with access to the EHR, it would certainly facilitate them getting their payments if the clinic were to take that on. It would probably be a much more streamlined way of handling it.
But just to be clear, we don't address that in the NPRM, and if people have comments or suggestions about ways that states should or could audit the provider for complying with those requirements, we'd love to hear it.
A couple things. do you guys have a few minutes? I suspect we still have questions that we can go over. I don't know what your time constraints are.
I think we can go 5 minutes over.
Okay. Operator, do we still have questions in the queue?
Yes, sir. Bill,
yes. This is Pete McGee. I've got a follow-up question.
Pete, can you, just so we get some other people in with some other questions, can you follow up with me and we'll try and get an answer for you, whatever your follow-up is?
Okay, great.
Thanks. Go ahead, operator. Next question.
Your next question will come from.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, this is Brian Cox. I'm calling from Linton, Indiana. My question is also about the PAs. There are very strict guidelines in Indiana versus like a nurse practitioner on the guidelines they have to follow in a rural health clinic. And my question was how they're going to quantify that as physician-led as well. And it sounds like I just need to make a comment.
Yeah, I would encourage you to make a comment about how that specifically comports with Indiana if there are specific state laws and regulations. Again, that's the kind of information we need to know is how does this play out with existing state rules and definitions of these terms.
Okay. Thank you.
I think in this case, Bill is one of the people who knows more about the genesis of the PA-led language than we do, but our opportunity to change anything in the proposed rule is only as far as we have substantial comments or informed comments to that effect.
And unfortunately, you're right. I probably do more than I'd like to know about how this thing all evolved. But we'll get it worked out. Next question, operator.
And that'll come from?
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Helen Whittington from Parkside Family Clinic in Coral, Texas, and I think mine is like a follow-up question because someone just asked. We were wondering if the incentive payment was per provider. We are an independent rural health clinic, or is it just for the facility?
No, the payments don't. They're not per facility. They are per provider or per eligible professional, and they will assign the payment to a eligible tax ID number. However, the eligible hospitals, the acute care hospitals and the children's hospitals, it is per facility for those.
So just to be clear, because this continues to be a question, no institution is eligible for an incentive payment aside from, as proposed, the children's hospitals and the acute care hospitals. Otherwise, this is a program about eligible professionals who have the voluntary option of assigning their payment to employers, and that's discussed in the MPRM, or they can keep it themselves and we don't get involved in how they use their payments.
So if we have four providers, one being a PA, only three are EPs because our facility or rural health clinic is not led by a PA.
If the other three EPs meet the list that Michelle went through, then that would be correct.
Okay.
Although the only thing I would say is we don't know what PA-led means at this point, so we can't presume that you wouldn't be able to meet that depending upon how it's defined.
Okay.
It sounds like you might not be able to, but it's conceivable there would be a definition under which even your PA could be classified as being covered. But
thank you very much.
Thanks. Next question, caller.
And that will come from?
Yes, I'm Jenny Tuft with Moab, Utah Independent Rural Health Clinic. I had a question regarding the voluntary for states to implement with the Medicaid program. Is there anything providers can do to facilitate their state in going forward with that?
Concerned citizens can always get involved.
We haven't heard that there is a state that is going to wholesale not participate. That said, as Michelle described, we're only giving 90 cents on the dollar, and some states are in real, as you know better than us, in real dire financial straits. So for me, it's not so much are they going to participate or not, but the extent of participation and in what year. Are they going to do it right away or later? Is this going to be a priority or not, and how is it going to go? A lot of it has to do with how they can come up with that 10% match, in addition to, of course, other factors. But I do think that demonstrating provider interest in helping with the planning, the stakeholder involvement, addressing issues such as security and consent and provider outreach and so forth, all of those resources brought to bear probably make it a more tenable situation for state Medicaid agencies. They knew that they had that assistance.
I would absolutely say a critical mass of providers demanding that this program take place will move mountains.
The other thing I think to keep in mind is that the whenever your state adopts the plan, whether it's in 2010 or 2011 or 2012, you are eligible for that first year for the adoption, implementation, upgrading, that larger payment, absent meaningful use, regardless of what year your state moves ahead. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you're not going to, but if your state is behind other states, other than getting the benefit of having an EHR, you lose nothing financially if your state, you know, doesn't do this till next year. It just means you won't start. Your first year may not be till 2011 or 2012, whereas another state might be 2010. But in the end, as a provider, you're going to get the same amount regardless of what state you're in, as long as you meet all the criteria.
Okay, so if our state decides not to join until next year, we would still be eligible for payment, or even, let's say, 2012, we would still be eligible or get back payment for 2011?
Well,
is that,
you would.
Is that what I'm understanding?
You get a first-year adoption, implementation, and upgrade, and 5 years of meaningful use under Medicaid, regardless of when it starts.
Right.
So it wouldn't be a back funding. But so if you went 2012, you would go 2012 adoption, implementation, upgrade, and then 5 years of meaningful use to 20, what would that be on my math, 2018, versus another state that might start in 2010, then that provider's payments, incentive payments, would expire in 2016.
Okay.
So you're going
to
get...
Any suggestions on best way to contact our state, or who would we contact within our state?
Contact me, you know, through an email. We can talk about that, and I can give you some ideas. Send an email to me at info@narhc.org.
Okay. And Jenny, I was just on a panel with your state's CIO yesterday, and I think he's extremely interested in engaging. He's the CIO for your Health and Human Services Agency, and he's very, very interested, so I wouldn't worry about Utah.
Good, good. I didn't see them on the list, so I just thought I'd check. Thank you.
I'm going to have to make the next one the last question in order to be respectful of the time for our guests and the fact that they have gone over. So, operator, what's our next question?
Your final question will come from. Caller, please state your name.
Hi, Marty Bennett from Riverside Family Medicine in South Louisiana. Since there is no certification criteria yet established for meaningful use, is there any, if you were to guess, is there an estimated time frame at which we might see that forthcoming?
Sure. We're all planning, ONC and CMS are planning to finalize all three of these proposed rules or interim final rule in late spring, and I just want to remind everyone that technically spring goes through the end of June, so I would probably hang your hat there. So the goal is to have them all finalized in late spring, and then because the ONC rule about EHR certification was an interim final, it actually already is in effect, and it went into effect 30 days after its publication in January. But it might get changed because our meaningful use definition might get changed, and also as a result of their public comment. That said, so the reason I say that is because the vendors, I think, are already responding, and they're already working on this. But the domino effect, the backward dependencies are these rules have to be made final late spring. EHRs, the vendors, or whoever is developing them, have to then take that criteria, integrate that into their EHRs if there is a gap, and then they have to go to the certifying bodies that are proposed by the Office of National Coordinator and receive their certification. So they get their little stamp, that's it, you're done, you're great, you have the best EHR, and then the providers have to upgrade it or adopt it or upgrade to it. So all of that has to happen, and then you would demonstrate to the state that you had done so. So you can see there's a lot of interdependency on the market and on the process by which EHRs will be certified before you can even get there. In the meantime, we feel like states can get a lot of the IT and policy and other systems ready. The use case for why to adopt HIT&E can be discussed. You can talk about the value of it. You can talk about how you would integrate it into your workflow. I mean, just thinking about Pete from Arkansas has been doing this since 2004. He'll probably tell you that it's not so easy. There's a challenge to get it going. So all of those are things that you could be discussing and starting to think about while you're waiting for your state to be ready and for the market to be ready to actually adopt or upgrade.
Well, I just want to thank you. This has been an exceptionally informative forum, and it has answered some long-standing questions. I appreciate your time today.
Sure. Thank you, Marty.
Well, we hope that you guys will be able to submit some good comments for the NPRM. We think these issues are very important, and we hope to address them in the final rule.
And I would encourage you individually to do that. We as an organization will be taking advantage of the opportunity to do so. I want to thank both of our speakers today, Jessica and Michelle, for the time that they've spent with us and trying to help answer questions and help people better understand what is out there with regard to the meaningful use criteria and the opportunities for rural health clinics. I also want to thank all of our participations and the Office of Rural Health Policy for sponsoring this series. A transcript and an audio recording of today's call will be made available on the ORHP website, hopefully in the not-too-distant future. We have a process of review and clearance that we have to go through to get that posted. I want to encourage you to encourage others to participate in this series as we become available. If you're not on our listserv to get information about it, the email or the website address I gave you earlier can give you instructions on how to sign up so you receive the information. We will be setting the next rural teleconference for April and hopefully back on our Tuesday, 2 o'clock Eastern schedule, but we will get information out on that. Again, I want to thank all of our participants and thank our speakers for the valuable information and look forward to talking to you on our next call. Thank you.
Ladies
Operator, we're clear.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's presentation. We do thank everyone for your participation.